One of the challenges in doing a workshop here at Holden, particularly for my first time, is not having a clue on why people choose to come here, who I would be addressing. And the challenge for me is the program that I work with is very specific, and I work with kids and the challenges that are particular to Portland, and that being the influence of gangs and drugs and how that's affected our city and the church's ministry. So I'm trying to look at how I can broaden that to realistically address some of your concerns. And it also helps me to understand what you're interested in. Yes?
I think I'm interested in, we've been on the outside of the skirts in Seattle, and are seeing gang influence more and more in the suburbs. In the middle school where my children go, and I don't know if that in many of the high schools in the area, but it's a real worry.
And well, it should be. One of the other pieces that I'd like to do, just kind of building on getting to know each other, is some of the risk factors. If we could kind of brainstorm on what some of the risk factors that we see affecting youth. But I'd like to begin by asking, how many here see youth in your community as being at risk? Great. Because I definitely believe all youth are at risk. And, you know, given divorce, given the drug and alcohol, all the influences affecting youth in our communities, that all youth are at risk. So that's something that I think is a common denominator for us all. But to go from there with some of the risk factors that are pertinent to the Northwest is how the gang reality began. There's a real system to that. And as you mentioned, it's definitely, if not affecting your community, is very likely to affect your community in the near future. What occurred in major metropolitan areas, beginning with in LA, is some years ago, there were drug lords and gang leaders that actually sat up in meetings, much the way we're talking today, and looked at marketing drugs and, you know, as a profit, and how could they go about doing that. And they looked at major metropolitan areas, and they looked at the reality that institutions like Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Boys Clubs, Girls Clubs, those institutions that had been meeting the cultural and some of the identity needs of youth, that as those resources left the community, they actually sat down and planned, don't worry Dave, I can yell louder than they can.
We'll see.
Okay, yeah, it's a really challenge. So drug lords and gang leaders actually sat down and they planned on how they could market their profit. And so what they did, beginning in LA, is they looked at major metropolitan areas where there were no social, cultural outlets for youth because of those movements of resources out of urban areas. And they looked at the I-5 corridor, Highway 5, going from LA all the way up to Vancouver, Canada. And they actually sent out young people, gang leaders, into those communities, bought homes or rented homes, and established clubs, if you will, as places where youth could come when school was out, and that would be a place where they would be able to hang out and have a place where they would experience a sense of belonging, bonding, and attachment. That's how gangs began in that area. So that if you look at Los Angeles to Sacramento, Oakland, Sacramento, Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver, that those are places where it began out of actual meetings and a plan to set up gangs as a place where those drugs would be infused, and it's a marketing tool for those leaders.
So they actually began as a community. Establishing a community for kids,
but exactly out of the model that we had in cities that were needs that were being met by boys clubs, girls clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, so that it's all about the cultural identity of young people, a place where young people had a sense of belonging, community, family, that looking at those basic human needs and infusing into that drugs and gain membership. And and the work that I've done in trying to get kids out of gangs, out of that sense of belonging, it's a lot like the, those who have gone through, I forget what we used to have, the, some of the religious organizations that, you know, when people are trying to break away from that kind of attachment, it's really very difficult because they've invested so much of themselves. It's also very similar, I'm told, to a wife who's been in an abusive relationship, or a spouse who's been in a, involved in an abusive relationship, that it's a psychological dependency that's far greater than any other threat.
Kelly, what was the target age group?
I don't know what the target age group was, but I know very much high school. Today's reality, that as those high schoolers have been models for younger people, it's middle school and elementary school that's a lot of the focus. And that's the targeted age group that I work with most, are middle school and high school. Yes?
Why do you feel that groups such as Boy Scouts and Boys and Girls Clubs and things that at one time filled that need, why they no longer are able to do that?
Diminishing resources. The dollars to make that happen, the adult volunteers, the whole definition of community. As you look at over the last 25 years, how that has been missing in the urban area. You know, that, you know, suburban areas got stronger and urban areas got weaker. And now, of course, suburban areas are going through the same thing that happened in urban areas for so long. But it all has to do with resources. So that's the basis of the problem, and the response to the problem that I've been working at for a little over 2 years is coming back in a very simple message, and it's like pounding a drum consistently. It's reestablishing a sense of culture and identity for young people. And we do that in a number of various ways. To just briefly talk about some of those ways. One is I take kids, each month there are 8 children, youth, these are high school youth, that I take out to a Western Culinary Institute. When I first started this program, time out again, one of the real challenges of this program are resources. We don't have enough money to really make the program work. So we're always looking for more resources. So I do also have a sign-up list here for people. So that you know that at the end of this presentation. Now, back to what I was saying about the Culinary Institute. I went out, one of the first things, and all we had was my salary for the first year. So what I did is I went out to a business. It's a Western Culinary Institute where they train chefs to become chefs and go out into restaurants. And they do a meal that people pay $15 for, but if you went out to a restaurant, you pay $45 to $60. A 6-course meal. And I asked them if they would sponsor a dinner each month for 8 kids, and they said they wouldn't do that, but they would provide that at cost. So each month we pay $5 per kid to take them out to that meal. And we have doctors and lawyers and people from the African American community to come along as role models and go through that meal with them. And that's really a wonderful thing because it's something that we can approach volunteers to do, and every adult knows how to eat, or at least can fake it. So we've had the best musician, the best drummer, jazz drummer in the Portland area, one of the best local group leaders out for that meal. We've had doctors, we've had politicians. So we have role models who go through that meal, and that's been a really successful part of the program. Another program that we have going, and again, the focus of all this, again, the theme is reestablishing cultural identity for kids. And have them see a sense of, you know, kind of perking their imagination that, yeah, I can do this if I work hard, if I establish discipline in my life. And then they're also there with adults that they can imagine as their role models. So another thing that we're doing, we're really excited about this month, is there is a owner of a 5-star restaurant. It's called Wilf's Restaurant in Portland. And she's going to allow us this in August to bring 25 kids in. She's going to train them as waiters and waitresses on a Saturday. So they'll go through a 6-hour training. Then on that Sunday, those same youth will be able to invite their parents to come out for dinner, and those youth will serve dinner to their parents in this 5-star restaurant. That's just a wonderful program because that encompasses you know, vocational training. There's a lot of etiquette and culture that you learn about around that. But then the really powerful side of that, too, is that they're doing something for their parents. Another important part of the program and the culture is taking these kids from the stigma of being at risk to being having something to offer. We have two choirs that we've begun working with kids, and these kids live in an area called Crack Alley. And they're from ages 7 through 15, and we have about 30 kids. And that's a gospel choir. It's a neighborhood youth choir. And these kids, we've been doing this program for about a year and a half. They meet every Saturday for rehearsal. And beginning in April, they really took off. They've been out in churches and performing every Sunday since then. So that's taking these kids who are, you know, kind of in the stigma of being disposable to having something to offer. And I preached, as they sang a couple of weeks ago, and it was wonderful to see this church with, you know, 200, 300 people, you know, really applauding the performance of these kids in the context of worship. That's another great one. And the final one I'll say right now about the program is that the eating program, the model for that one, is communion. That when we have communion as a church, our tradition is that we recognize that that's something that's basic to our human existence. And it's also something that we don't just do by ourselves. When we eat, it's a relationship that we acknowledge with the rest of the world. And it's that same kind of power that I believe when we take these kids out for the meal. So that's a model of the core of our existence, that we don't live alone, but we're in relationship to the rest of the world. So with that, I'm going to pass this out, and I'm going to stop talking for a moment and share a videotape. This is about a 7-minute videotape, and the intent of it is just a little more recognition about not just this program, but the power of the church. You know, to take a very simple vision and make it a powerful expression to the whole community. So I can make this work. Anyone has any special prayers to the video gods, that would be really helpful. Okay.
I think it's a good technician.
We need a
12-year-old
kid here.
That's
right.
Paula, could you? Do you? One of the, I hope that as I'm specific, that you can help us to generalize this some, okay? Because my experiences in working with Portland, and you can help to connect this with your local community, and you can also make suggestions on how it may improve the ministry that we're doing here in Portland. When I came to Portland, it was 5 years ago, and it was to work in an Episcopal school, Oregon Episcopal School. You may know of that school from the accident on Mount Hood. I came the year after that accident, and I think I'll save the rest of that story till after the tape. Thank you, Paul. You did a great job. Could you turn that down a little bit?
I'm going to do a blind lunch too. Maybe? I thought you turned that one off.
Well, I found the TV.
There wasn't anybody in that thing.
Other sound.
Can we do blind lunch?
No.
That's great. Thank you. This is only about a 7-minute clip of three.
Gang violence, murder, falls too often they intrude on everyday life in many parts of Portland. That makes the advantage of the holiday season to bring some relief to a group of children at Fall Gallery for it.
The sounds of this season from the children of some of Portland's meanest streets. Kids who all too often live with other sounds. In neighborhoods like this one, violence seems a way of life at times. The volunteers who run the community project for at-risk youth are trying to give these kids something else. And new friends. At-risk kids paired with senior class members from Oregon Episcopal School. Students like Erica Langler and her new friend, Carlin Billingsley.
Well, I just think it's really good for the kids and stuff because they don't have to be as fortunate as us. And so it's really neat, I think, that the whole school is able to get together and do this.
Truly to celebrate the diversity that exists here in Northeast Portland. We have kids that come from all over the world, every ethnic background, and it's just a wonderful opportunity to bring them together.
And to give them a future, give them some hope.
I know I'm inspired by seeing what's happened through the kids and what they put together, and it can only instill hope in the youth who are here today, and to see that by the looks on their faces.
And isn't that what this season is really all about? In Northeast Portland, the photographer Morris Banks. Paul Young, Newsroom 6.
As gangs and gang violence become a way of life for some Portland children, many are doing what they can to teach kids a different way of life. The Jim Hyde Report and Northeast Portland volunteers are doing their part with a program called Kids at Risk.
The singing and celebrating of Beaver Lutheran Church in Northeast Portland is deliberately multiracial today. The community Christmas party pairs 100 students from the Oregon Episcopal School in Southwest Portland with young people from the city's north and northeast side. Although a young man was killed in a gang fight just a few blocks from here on Wednesday, this party is part of a campaign to celebrate life for kids growing up in the neighborhood.
What people hear about the Northeast community is often, the bad news. But there's wonderful diversity here. The kids are loving. It's just a matter of getting us. It's what it takes for all those wonderful parts of the human being to come out.
Students from Jefferson High helped too, as did volunteers from the Community Youth at Risk program. But the scope was not limited to this city or country. Among the newest residents of the party, this family emigrated from Russia just last month.
The volunteers on this project say they have no grand theory about what causes a child being at risk. They work with people as individuals. But if that risk comes from crime, drugs, or affinity for gangs, that's where the attention is focused. But everyone can benefit from a community Christmas.
Here, we've got a couple of things for you right now, okay?
There's a gift for every one of the youngsters.
There we go.
But much of what they share with their partners today is intangible and invaluable.
Merry Christmas.
It is. It's a lot of fun. Sunday is really nice. It's a great way to get to know the different kids. And I wish I was a senior because then I can do it more next year, but oh well.
You've been having fun together this morning.
Almost no one has more influence over a little kid than a bigger kid. And today, kids from Jefferson High School and Oregon Episcopal School took some young ones under their wing for a Christmas celebration. This gathering at the Beamery Lutheran Church in inner Northeast Portland brought together the high school students and young low-income children from the neighborhood. This is the second year for the Christmas party, which was organized to help provide good role models and build self-esteem in so-called high-risk children. And to the kids, it was just a party.
Another thing that I should point out is that we were covered in the the December issue of the Lutheran. So there's a little bit in there too. I'm not real happy with the article. They plastered my face all over the magazine. It didn't have a lot of substance, but it's in here too. So it's another place where you can get some of the church's acknowledgement and acknowledgement that we have a really difficult challenge before us, and it's an opportunity for the church to really witness. Just to go through again, I'll go back to the Christmas party. And when I began this ministry, all we had was enough money for my salary. And so I had to look at how can we actually get some program going since we don't have program money. I used to direct the residence program, the dormitory at Oregon Episcopal School. So the first year that I left to do this ministry, I went back to the school and asked the students in the dormitory, who were 40 students, if they would sponsor a Christmas party for 40 kids from Redeemer. And the kids from Redeemer are not members of the congregation, but kids who have been involved in that church's mission through the Vacation Church School. It's a tremendous Vacation Church School. So I matched 40 of those kids with 40 kids from the Redeemer Church School. And again, those kids live in an area that's called Crack Alley. And I'll talk a little bit about that too. But with that, matching those 40 kids, and we had a group called the Martin Luther King Choir, a local choir from an elementary school, and that choir had been to Washington, D.C. To sing before the president. And we had the professional puppet troupe come in, and we provided lunch. So by the time that event came about, there were 180 children at that event. And that was the first one. And then this one that you saw, we had scheduled 100 students. I went to the upper school student body and approached them to get 100 students. And that happened just like that. We had 100 students from Oregon Episcopal School. We matched them with 100 kids from Redeemer's Vacation Church School. And we had 300 kids at that Christmas party. So we don't know what we'll do this year. But that's the kind of response to a very simple plan or vision for bringing kids into relationship. Another thing that's really powerful about that to me is that there are youth who are doing this. You know, that we could have very easily gone out to churches or places and had adults there. But the fact that there are youth who are sponsoring this program, activity like that, really makes a powerful message to the community. Particularly when Oregon Episcopal School, for example, is a very affluent, advantaged student body. And of course, the student body that we're talking about, the kids that we work with in the program are disadvantaged. And so bringing those youth together is a powerful message about the future, that there's got to be some way for these kids to come into some interaction if there's even going to be a future. And the relationship, the way it's set up, is that it's going to be played out the same way it was in my childhood, that if you're white, you wind up being in the positions of power. If you're a person of color, then you have a subordinate relationship. And so the very least that I hope to do out of these kinds of programs is to bring people in the relationship so that at least they can imagine that they have a shared role in the future. The area surrounding Redeemer Lutheran Church is an area called Crack Alley. And just a couple of examples of the power and the fright of what's before us in Portland, and I guarantee you in your community there are very similar places. One example is the Crack Alley. I take kids home, and because I work in relationship with these kids, I'm just Kelly and they're just kids. But at times I'm not thinking, and I'm taking a kid home, and reality hits as I drive through their neighborhood. I drop them off at the house, and then on the way back, and I stop at a stop sign. And there's a young man standing on the corner and assuming that I'm not stopping because I'm obeying the law, but stopping because I want to buy cocaine or heroin. Now, that's an opportunity for that person to make a deal. Now, I know that you would be frightened going through that situation. And I don't know whether you would assume that because of my association with the kids and because I'm African American that I wouldn't be. But I am very much frightened by the reality that as a middle class person, that I can't drive down the street without someone assuming or approaching me about doing something illegal. And it's a terrible situation to think about people living in their neighborhoods and not being accosted in that way. And it's a whole issue about reclaiming neighborhoods and communities. So I just kind of got off on that one. But that's one of the realities. Another reality is that I work as, one of my roles is I'm a volunteer, I'm a counselor in a Catholic school, which 50% of the student body in that Catholic school are at risk. And I had a program over spring break where I took a bunch of kids bowling. And there was a Native American boy who was supposed to go bowling and didn't show up. So I went to his house to pick him up, assuming that he'd forgotten. I went to this door and I knocked, and the door opened violently, and there were two young men who would have been if I hadn't had my collar on. I was shocked because, again, I'm in relationship with this kid, and I don't think about the risk factors surrounding his life. And I was just very glad that I had my collar on that day. And the reality was that his house is also a gang house, where his siblings are members of a gang. And that's just that radical difference within our city, that there's another reality, there's another city. But that's just, you know, I share that. And please, you know, raise your hand or take this in another direction. I don't mean to give you so much information about my experience with this program that it takes you out of your reality of you know, we need to find some common ground for a dialogue. Yes?
This may go in a direction that people don't want to go, but it's very frustrating for me to think about drug-infested communities. It seems to me so obvious that legalizing drugs, taking that whole profit motive, those, you know, those guys that had those meetings and made those plans would not have had that meeting, would not have made those plans, would not have created a whole marketing system aimed at the most vulnerable people in the society. Those salesmen wouldn't be out there harassing people, as well as shooting each other, as well as getting thrown into jail by huge numbers and killed off by huge numbers. And that whole system could be deflated instantly. Not to say that a new community would then be there. I mean, your work, our work in building, rebuilding community still has to go on. But this whole illegal, murderous drug industry doesn't have to be there. The jails don't have to be filled with drug users and drug sellers. It will just treat it essentially in the same way that we do with even more murderous drugs like tobacco and alcohol, and then can start talking really honestly about what all of these drugs and food products that we're consuming and being killed by, we can start really dealing with that. But so much of our community is out of control because of that drug trade, and jails are full. I feel like that issue of legalizing drugs is an important key to being able to get recontrol of the most troubled communities and the rest of the community too.
Well, let me respond to that, and I invite anyone else to jump in, please. The reality of the issue of drugs and legalization or not legalization is an important issue. But my focus is that we have our society has really created is a disposable society, and that's primarily poor people and people of color. And what my aggressive belief is that this is a real opportunity for the church to reclaim relationship with those persons. That where there's a systemic problem that is created by our policy with drugs and just that whole cycle of violence. But for the church, it's a real opportunity to develop a powerful relationship with people and put a new light on the church as Father, I just said that. It's a powerful opportunity for the church if we'll just claim it. That's my whole focus. And this little program, for example, to be able to bring the business person who wants to bring 25 kids into her restaurant, it's a powerful expression of church to bring a business person in relationship, not only with those kids, but with the church. The same thing with the Culinary Institute. It's a wonderful opportunity. Now that's aside from the issue of the policy angle that has to be addressed. But while that craziness is going on and debate is going on, there's so much that can be done. It's an alternative to the craziness.
Kelly, what are some of your strategies for reaching those kids and getting and actually, you mentioned your vacation Bible school and what an important tool that was, and that the kids were not necessarily members of your church. I think about our church and even our proximity to a low-income housing. But for whatever reason, we are not reaching those kids. They're not feeling welcome at our church, or somehow we're not yeah. doing what we need to do to get them there.
Yeah. That's another really important point that Paul has suggested that I might have started with today. And that's that there's a piece of social analysis that we really ought to know as a church and as a body that's committed to, so say we're committed to multicultural expression. And that's recognizing the cultural identity of other people. You know? And just briefly what that is that European people have a value system that they view themselves, their identity comes out of relationship to object. How much education do you have? You know, what size is your house? What is your income? That comes out of a cultural heritage that it's really important to conquer those objects or to have a relationship. That's really how European people develop esteem. It's critical. Okay. African American, Hispanic, and Native American people, their esteem comes out of a sense of relationship. And then for Asian people, it comes out of relationship to the dynasty, you know, speaking with one voice. I think it's really critical to have that understanding of other people in order to have a dialogue, in order to really have relationship, to understand what is important to the basic understanding of who we are. So that if your church wants to have a relationship with African American people or whoever the people are in that housing development, understand what's important to them.
Well, I think most, and Dennis, you could interject here, we same town. But most of those people are Northern European extraction, because our town is, 97% probably.
Yeah.
Is there a technique? Is there how do you invite people? You know, how are we missing that boat? How are we not inviting a population in the right way so that they feel at home?
Are you marketing your program the same way Kelly talked about how the gang sat down and actually had what amount of marketing strategy for going into these other areas? Maybe just what he's saying, you know, getting to know more about the people themselves in that project and actually making sure that your program is marketed so they know that they are welcome and that there are certain things that they will be doing and there won't be a cost and, you know, anything that might be a drawback to them that they might not know about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what that's the question I'm asking, you know, what are some marketing techniques?
Dave, please.
What? I was going to say, we have a small community, part of our problem, if you speak out to a church, is we're not marketing product anybody wants. I mean, Lutheran worship is not a need for the kids in Kelly's neighborhood, nor are they any for the Hispanics in our neighborhood. And that's part of the problem.
And that's not part of the, you know, I'm thinking about how did Kelly market their vacation Bible school so that the neighborhood kid wanted to come to vacation Bible school and felt welcome there? How do you market your youth program so that the kids who are in middle school and high school that live at the project want to come and be part of your middle and high school youth program?
I understand your question, and I think two important points. First is to ask the question, you know, because until you do that, you're not doing anything. And the second part is to, and this is a critical piece too, is wanting the people. And I think, you know, spending time, you know, preparing, marketing is a part of that. But if you really want the people or you want the program, that's the critical piece. So often, like with the Vacation Church School, that program ran for a couple of years before it took off, because there were people that wanted it and there were people that didn't want it. And the real commitment began after having it a couple of years and some successes. Excuse me.
Well, it seems to me part of it is when you deal with somebody else in terms of Christianity or whatever, and you do something to them, it's different than having them real. I hear one of the keys to what you're doing is having the kids say, I am important, I am somebody, I fit somewhere. And it seems to me that the church needs to be about those sorts of questions. And to take youth and say, yes, you are important, I'll listen to you, I'll listen to your ideas, what you're going to say. And so, maybe providing some kind of fellowship, maybe some place where they are important, where they're real people, where they're listened to, where they're encouraged to dream and do whatever. It just seems to me that they're missing the boat. I mean, it's like, if a multimillionaire came in and said, come to my house because I want to change you, I wouldn't go at all. And I think, what do they need? What do the kids need is essential.
If I can just jump in with what you said, if you have any self-esteem, you wouldn't go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I used to work with homeless people in D.C., and the term was, there were people that would respond to something like that, if somebody's going to do something for you, but they called it taking a dive. You know, that you weren't doing it because of self-esteem, you were doing it because it was a freebie. And it's kind of basically taking a dive. It's losing a part of your humanity in the process. Yeah, so I certainly agree. But I think, you know, a group like this, the question that you asked, if we just spend an hour talking about it, that in itself is, it's a step in the right direction. You know, spending some time, maybe you're not with the people, but, you know, talking about it, brainstorming, marketing, and it's a step in the right direction, in my belief. But I don't know any more than you do. I know more about African-American kids. I know more about poor kids. I mean, that's my expertise, but we all have the same power.
I feel like some doors are opening in our congregation about doing some of those things. We started a preschool and have a scholarship program and we have some parents from that neighborhood who are bringing their kids and participating in the program because of the scholarships. And so, we're starting, but it's just, you know, getting more of that involvement. And I guess there's something, and I don't know if it's just our community or communities in general, but the neighborhood that our church is in, most of the people don't live in our neighborhood. In the neighborhood of the church, rather. They come, they drive there, and they drive away.
And you don't know
the people across the street, and the children across the street. They could be coming, but they're not.
That's not the exception to the rule. In the urban areas. Yes, ma'am.
I think that one-on-one is terribly significant in role modeling or even communicating. I work with homeless women in Washington, D.C. And what I learned over the last 6 months is, bring your darn turkey dinners. We don't like turkey, but if you'll sit down and talk with us, we'll consider eating it. But what do you think about when you go back to suburbia Maryland and talk to me here, person to person? And so I've started with maybe five different we're homeless women who are in different homes now. And I have found a rich enrichment for me by finding out about these people as human beings, and they in turn. And I finally, about 2 months ago, one of them called me on the telephone. And you know, that means she put 25 cents in a machine to talk. And I felt like it was kind of the first real evidence that she trusted me at all, that we have a one-on-one relationship. So it seems like for kids too, that one-on-one and caring beyond that one Christmas celebration is what also becomes important for reaching out to any kind of community project, whether kids or adults.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you also point out is really helpful, and the whole thing about empowerment, and that it's a progression, and I'm not there yet, the church isn't there yet, but it's a beginning point. I remember, again, when I was in Washington, D.C., and I thought I was hot shit as far as going out and, you know, caring for people and everything, and I went out to a homeless man who was on a grate, and I had a cup of hot coffee, and I tried to give it to him, and he denied it. I was blown away. Here's a guy that doesn't have anything, and he turned down a hot cup of coffee from me, of all people. And so that was really helpful for me because it told me that there's a progression. That just because I have it doesn't mean that somebody else is prepared to or needs to take that. And so that's something I really would encourage for the church as well, and that we have our own learning process to go through also. That because we have it, doesn't mean that it's time for that person to receive it. You know, that being in relationship is more important. Being in relationship is even more important than what we have to give to each other. I firmly believe that.
You better get a core of people, I think, that are willing to commit themselves to those relationships. And that's not always the easiest thing to do. And we've got a youth pastor that's been there quite a long time, and he has built a core of college-age kids and young, you know, working-age kids that are his prime staff people in working with the high school and the junior high kids, and that will commit to being in relationships with these kids on a weekly basis and going to the games and, you know, doing trips and all that kind of stuff. And often it's some of those younger relationships that are the key rather than what this one, you know, the pastor person can really do. And having real open-ended activities are the come-and-see kinds of activities, not churchy activities, but just things that kids would want to do that are fun kinds of things that get them involved. The other thing the church has got to be willing to tolerate the kind of, you know, damage to property and unpopular social behavior, etc., that comes with inviting a diverse group of kids in to use your facilities or do whatever, you know. It's not the easiest thing. You got to really, I think through those things and have the commitment of the whole community to move in that way.
Yes. I agree with everything you said.
Is this peer support network, are you targeting children before they are involved with gangs? Do you have any interaction with actual gangs in Portland? Have you seen any changes in that situation in Northeast Portland?
Right, but there are two areas where I don't feel that I have particular expertise. One is working with severe gang members, people that are really caught up in gangs, and the other are teenage girls. And to be honest, I'm more afraid of the teenage girls. I don't care what their background is than the gang members. Well, a teenage girl just knows how to have control, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm speaking primarily middle school age, too, but I just talk so much I almost forgot the question. As far as with gang members, I don't have a lot of direct contact. What we do, for example, is we sponsor Saturday Gym, and on that Saturday Gym there's 100 to 200 African American males. That's the most at-risk population. Many of those kids are in gangs. And my role is that we pay for that gym to happen, for the staff person, and then I'm just there present. And they know that it's the church that's sponsoring that. So that's the relationship. And the goal of that program is to get a number of clergy from the African American community, storefront churches, to come there as well, to be present. So that shows those kids, again, the cultural identity, that their church cares. And that's an opportunity for these kids to come back to church. Too often, they only see their neighborhood pastor after there's been a killing. And the gang members go back to the church for the funeral. So I really want to use the gym as a place where they see the adults caring and sharing in their culture. That's the biggest place. And in the school, the kids see me there. And, you know, when there's a death in the school, I'm in the halls, that kind of relationship. But I don't talk to the kids who are in gangs. I don't know what to say to them. It's a matter of just being present.
Maybe you've just answered the question that has been bothering me. In the film that you showed us, you had children paired, and I understand this was your only alternative, but you had children, African-American children and Caucasian children paired. I suppose that's really the least desirable, or is that desirable, or is it an age matter?
It's very astute, and the reality of that, again, is it's a progression. We're starting with a program that doesn't have funding, and the Christmas program develops credibility for the program, develops credibility for the church, and the way the church was publicized through that as doing something. It publicizes the program with the kids and seeing that the church is able to do something for them, i.e. a gift at Christmas time, that whole program. But where we want to go with this is to have more youth from the African American community that are mentoring younger kids from their community. But you know, if we had resources, I'd have a lot of programs like that where there's indigenous or African American kids modeling for other African American kids, but we don't have the resources to do that yet. I did write a proposal for a youth volunteer corps where we'll be using youth working with other youth, and I had funding for that $15,000, where those youth will go out and, you know, work on elderly people's homes and programs like that, bringing kids into relationship. And the final thing I'd say about that is that I would never want to get rid of this kind of program, because it's really important, especially for the most at-risk kids, to come into relationship with kids who have a life of promise. Because I know the advantage kids from having taught them, and I know that they don't have confidence that they can relate to kids from the at-risk community. And I'd assume that that's also true. Well, the other side of it is, for the at-risk kids, they don't believe that affluent kids care about them. So by the time they're adults, there's tremendous animosity and hatred by the time they're adults. So I can do something, this program could do something to eliminate that now and develop a partnership, peer relationship. So that's a personal commitment. That's not politically popular in the community, but I think it's an important role for the church.
Well, given you are the church, Christ-centered church, doing God's will through Christ, what is your mission? If you could just, what do the kids get from your church?
That the church cares, and the church is present. And then the other side of it that I do really believe is that the church has power. You know, and for disadvantaged children, children at risk, they need to have some attachment to some power, because their parents don't have it, their neighborhoods don't have it, and to have some institution that it tells them, you know, I can get an education, I can go someplace, I can go out to dinner, I can.
Control their destiny.
Yeah, yeah. And it really, it perks the imagination for children. But then it takes follow-through, and that's where we have, ideally, we have adults that come in and help instill that, enhance that. And again, I mean, we're talking about Portland, but I believe that this is true in any neighborhood, any community. And your church, your pastor, you can be doing the same things. But even beyond that, is you can be supporting this ministry individually or with your church, you know, to help this to continue.
So you don't necessarily bring kids in to talk about Jesus and Jesus' sayings and
no.
Jesus' life?
No,
and
no,
so you,
no.
Are you above it, below it, left, or right of it?
Well, I mean, it's obvious to them I'm a Lutheran pastor, so they know I believe it. And my belief since I was in high school has been, we live in a country where everybody has heard about Jesus Christ. But there are a lot of people who haven't seen it. And so I believe that talking too much is detrimental. I really do believe that. And I think that people need to see more. And there's a saying someone said that you may be the only Bible somebody will ever read. So I believe that. And it's not, there's nothing wrong with talking about the gospel. I do that in church. I do that where there's invitation to do that. But I don't believe that it's the most appropriate or effective way to talk about that to somebody who already believes that they know what I have to say and just waiting for me to say it. I'll wait. They'll ask.
I can't even remember what the statement is or how it goes, but there's something to the effect that if you walk up to a hungry person and say God loves you without giving them food, what does that tell them?
It didn't hurt me, the reality.
No. You have to start with them where they are, and that'll come. That's what I think you're doing. You're starting with them where they are. As that relationship grows, then their view of what Christianity is all about grows with it. But you can't just walk up to a little kid and say God loves you and do nothing else about where they are or what their life is like.
Now, Alan Cross has a book out called The Evangelization of North America, and he talks about how most of us view evangelism as getting people into church, but you know, he turns that around and says that, you know, the primary aim of Christ as he walked among us was not to get people into church, but to get the church into people. And, you know, to me, this ministry speaks to getting the church into the people. And, you know, you may in fact have a residual effect that brings some of the people into the institutional church. But, you know, it's a...
Yeah, it is. If I can, the people who are coming into church as a response to this are the restaurant owner, you know, the people in businesses who are saying, you know, this is not the kind of community that I want, or I can't do it by myself, and the church is doing something, and so they relate to the church as an institution with values and, you know, that are creating the kind of reality that they ultimately believe in. So those are the persons who are coming into church. Now, there are a lot of parents and kids that say to me, and this is, you know, a whole nother conversation, what church are you a pastor at? And I have to kind of cringe because I don't represent our worship service at all. And I know that when those people come to our church and sit through our worship service, they won't be able to wait to get out because, you know, it's just not something that they, I mean, it's not geared to them at all. Talk about knowing your people. So that's another part. But let me close with another story that goes, again, to the same point that we were talking about. And it has to do with the struggle of the church's identity and myself as a pastor. I came home from church early spring. And there were a couple messages on my machine that there were two kids who had died that weekend. One had committed suicide and the other had died and he had cancer. The kid who had cancer Now, when he died, there were about 50 staff and student body who were present with him as he died. The student who committed suicide did that alone in a closed bathroom and shot himself. And so the principal and some teachers and one of the youth had called because they really wanted me to be present in the school that day as students dealt with that. And this was at the high school. So I went to the high school. That was a really difficult morning for me. I came in and there were peer counselors, there were counselors, and there must have been about 30, 40 people in the room. They were sitting around, they were sharing, they were crying, and they were going through all this grief. And here I was with my collar on, you know, wanting to make a difference, and nobody was coming up to me. And I really felt like, you know, I'm not the daily relationship with these people. And so it was a very lonely, powerless feeling for me in going through that morning. And so I walked the halls, and I kept wanting someone to need me. You know, pastors know what that's like. We all know what that's like. I felt pretty worthless the whole time. So then finally I was standing in the hall, and there was a girl that came up to me, and she asked me to come into the room and asked me if I would lead them in prayer. And it was just a tremendous sense of relief for me that the church, that someone had identified me and needed me. You know? And so it's a powerful message about the church. So we went in that room and we formed a circle and we took turns praying. That's another powerful thing for the church, to pray in a school, in a public school. And so this is a powerful example about being present, going through that sense of powerlessness, and then that sense of relationship.